Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 479, titled World War II Era Lawsuit Against the Bush Family. This is being recorded on October 3rd of the year 2004. Before beginning the main body of the broadcast, let me remind you that the Spitfire website has all kinds of resources available. Spitfire is the CD duplication service that stocks the various programs and lectures that I've done over the years. By the way, I don't get any money from that. You can visit their website at www.spitfirelist.com, and they have all kinds of resources. Long, annotated, article-length descriptions of the For the Record shows, descriptions of the other programs and lectures available from Spitfire. There are links to the two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. More recent For the Record programs are streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, and older shows are available at a longer URL linked to both the www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, and the heroic WFMU is archiving the entire For the Record series on Real Audio. Also on the Spitfire website, and very relevant to what we're talking about in this broadcast, is first of all the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by the late heroic Paul Manning, and also a link to a website maintained by some listeners in the Midwest that has documents, declassified U.S. government documents, proving not only the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry, but in particular Prescott Bush Sr.'s involvement with institutions that were trafficking Nazi money out of Europe between 1945 and 1951, and veteran listeners will recognize that as being part of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. Now, research credit on the following article goes to a number of listeners. Many listeners have cited this one and sent this in to me. We've spoken at great length about not only the economic links or the functional links between American finance and industry and those of Nazi Germany, but in particular we've spoken about the primary position of the Bush family in these connections. There are many programs available from Spitfire, many descriptions on the Spitfire website that talk about this, in addition to the Martin Bormann Nazi in Exile, and that actually doesn't talk about the Bush family, but it mentions that it goes on at length about their business partners, the Thiessens, and some of the firms that the Bushes participated in, and of course the documents that are available on that website. But use the search function on the Spitfire website and you can locate this subject material. Now, the Guardian, that's the British Guardian, formerly called the Manchester Guardian, ran an article on September 25th of this year in which it was disclosed that two survivors of Auschwitz, both of them former slave laborers, have filed a civil action against the Bush family as a result of the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry. I have yet to see any mention of this in the American press. Surprise, surprise. It doesn't really shock anybody shouldn't shock anybody that they would not be mentioning this. But this is a very, very interesting article indeed, and I'm going to read that to you now. Again, tip of the hat to a number of listeners who sent this in. From The Guardian of Britain, Saturday, September 25th of 2004, an article by Ben Arris in Berlin and Duncan Campbell in Washington headlined, How Bush's Grandfather Helped Hitler's Rise to Power. Subtitle, Rumors of a Link Between the U.S. First Family and the Nazi War Machine have circulated for decades. Now, The Guardian can reveal how repercussions of events that culminated in action under the Trading with the Enemy Act are still being felt by today's president. George Bush's grandfather, the late U.S. Senator Prescott Bush, was a director and shareholder of companies that profited from their involvement with the financial backers of Nazi Germany. The Guardian has obtained confirmation from newly discovered files in the U.S. National Archives that a firm of which Prescott Bush was a director was involved with the financial architects of Nazism. His business dealings, which continued until his company's assets were seized in 1942 under the Trading with the Enemy Act, has led more than 60 years later to a civil action for damages being brought in Germany against the Bush family by two former slave laborers at Auschwitz and to a hum of pre-election controversy. The evidence has also prompted one former U.S. Nazi war crimes prosecutor to argue that the late senator's action should have been grounds for prosecution for giving aid and comfort to the enemy. The debate over Prescott Bush's behavior has been bubbling under the surface for some time. There has been a steady internet chatter about the Bush-Nazi connection, much of it inaccurate and unfair. But the new documents, many of which were only declassified last year, show that even after America had entered the war, and when there was already significant information about the Nazis' plans and policies, he worked for and profited from companies closely involved with the very German businesses that financed Hitler's rise to power. It has also been suggested that the money he made from these dealings helped to establish the Bush family fortune and set up its political dynasty. Remarkably, little of Bush's dealings with Germany has received public scrutiny, partly because of the secret status of the documentation involving him. But now, the multi-billion-dollar legal action for damages by two Holocaust survivors against the Bush family and the imminent publication of three books on the subject are threatening to make Prescott Bush's business history an uncomfortable issue for his grandson, George W., as he seeks re-election. While there is no suggestion that Prescott Bush was sympathetic to the Nazi cause, the documents reveal that the firm he worked for, Brown Brothers Harriman, acted as a U.S. base for the German industrialist Fritz Thyssen, who helped finance Hitler in the 1930s before falling out with him at the end of the decade. The Guardian has seen evidence that shows Bush was the director of the New York-based Union Banking Corporation that represented Thyssen's U.S. interests, and he continued to work for the bank after America went to war. Bush was also on the board of at least one of the companies that formed part of a multinational network of front companies to allow Thyssen to move assets around the world. Thyssen owned the largest steel and coal company in Germany and grew rich from Hitler's efforts to rearm between the two world wars. One of the pillars in Thyssen's international corporate web, UBC, worked exclusively for and was owned by a Thyssen-controlled bank in the Netherlands. More tantalizing are Bush's links to the Consolidated Silesian Steel Company, or CSSC, based in mineral-rich Silesia on the German-Polish border. During the war, the company made use of Nazi slave labor from the concentration camps, including Auschwitz. The ownership of CSSC changed hands several times in the 1930s, but documents from the U.S. National Archive declassified last year link Bush to CSSC, although it's not clear if he and UBC were still involved in the company when Thyssen's American assets were seized in 1942. Three sets of archives spell out Prescott Bush's involvement. All three are readily available thanks to the efficient U.S. archive system and a helpful and dedicated staff at both the Library of Congress in Washington and the National Archives at the University of Maryland. The first set of files, the Harriman Papers in the Library of Congress, show that Prescott Bush was a director and shareholder of a number of companies involved with Thyssen. The second set of papers, which are in the National Archives, are contained in Vesting Order No. 248, which records the seizure of the company assets. What these files show is that on October 20, 1942, the alien property custodian seized the assets of the UBC, of which Prescott Bush was a director. Having gone through the books of the bank, further seizures were made against two affiliates, the Holland America Trading Corporation and the Seamless Steel Equipment Corporation. By November, the Silesian American Company, another of Prescott Bush's ventures, had also been seized. The third set of documents, also at the National Archives, are contained in the files on I.G. Farben, which was prosecuted for war crimes. A report issued by the Office of Alien Property Custodian in 1942 stated of the companies that, quote, "Since 1939, these steel and mining properties have been in possession of and have been operated by the German government, and have undoubtedly been of considerable assistance to that country's war effort." Prescott Bush, a 6-foot-4-inch charmer with a rich singing voice, was the founder of the Bush political dynasty and was once considered a potential presidential candidate himself. Like his son George and grandson George W., he went to Yale, where he was, again like his descendants, a member of the secretive and influential Skull and Bones Student Society. He was an artillery captain in the First World War and married Dorothy Walker, the daughter of George Herbert Walker, in 1921. In 1924, his father-in-law, a well-known St. Louis investment banker, helped set him up in business in New York with Averell Harriman, the wealthy son of railroad magnate E.H. Harriman in New York, who had gone into banking. One of the first jobs Walker gave Bush was to manage UBC. Bush was a founding member of the bank, and the incorporation documents, which list him as one of seven directors, show he owned one share in UBC worth $125. The bank was set up by Harriman and Bush's father-in-law to provide a U.S. bank for the Thiessens, Germany's most powerful industrial family. August Thiessen, the founder of the dynasty, had been a major contributor to Germany's First World War effort, and in the 1920s, he and his son Fritz and Heinrich established a network of overseas banks and companies so their assets and money could be whisked offshore if threatened again. By the way, parenthetically, this is a reference to the reparations payments that were required of German industry complicit in the war effort as a result of the Versailles Treaty. And as discussed in past broadcasts, a combination of the Webb-Pomerene Act, P-O-M-E-R-E-N-E, and the that basically was a loophole in the antitrust legislation in the United States, which enabled American high rollers, so to speak, barred from establishing monopolies in the United States, to hook up with their foreign counterparts and to establish cartels, which are international monopolies. A combination of the Webb-Pomerene Act, the U.S. industrial boom of the World War I era in the 1920s, and the Treaty of Versailles and the straits that put some of these German firms in my considered opinion, led to the real foundations of the phenomenon of globalization. And if some of this stuff seems to be long ago and far away, bear in mind that this is part of the international cartel system, which is at the foundation of globalization. And as we've seen in, among other programs, For the Record 370, the former head of the Bank for Handel and Schäfer, part of this financial triumvirate, who discovered that this firm was being used after World War II, again, after World War II, to recoup Nazi assets, he went, traveled to New York to talk with Prescott Bush and mysteriously died of a heart attack. And then, in 1996, a Dutch journalist named Eddie Rover, who was researching the Bush family Nazi connections and was going to interview Baron Heinrich Thiessen-Bornemisza, son of August Thiessen. Heinrich Thiessen-Bornemisza was a son of Fritz Thiessen. Heinrich Thiessen-Bornemisza is the head of ThyssenKrupp, and when he was going to be interviewed by Eddie Rover in 1996, Eddie Rover also mysteriously died of an apparent heart attack. And again, as noted in the documents that are available courtesy of John Buchanan and listeners in the Midwest, it is now a matter of record that Prescott Bush Sr. was involved with this milieu when these institutions were trafficking Nazi money abroad after World War II. And that and these mysterious deaths, which took place after World War II, need to be factored into basically factually accurate but somewhat tepid account here by The Guardian. Continuing, by the time Fritz Thiessen inherited the business empire in 1926, Germany's economic recovery was faltering. After hearing Adolf Hitler speak, Thiessen became mesmerized by the young firebrand. He joined the Nazi Party in December of 1931 and admits backing Hitler in his autobiography, I Paid Hitler, when the National Socialists were still a radical fringe party. He stepped in several times to bail out the struggling party. In 1928, Thiessen had bought the Barlow Palace on Brienerstrasse in Munich, which Hitler converted into the Brown House, the headquarters of the Nazi Party. The money came from another Thiessen overseas institution, the Bank for Handel und Schäfer in Rotterdam. By the late 1930s, Brown Brothers Harriman, which claimed to be the world's largest private investment bank and UBC, had bought and shipped millions of dollars of gold, fuel, steel, coal, and U.S. Treasury bonds to Germany, both feeding and financing Hitler's build-up to war. Between 1931 and 1933, UBC bought more than $8 million worth of gold, of which $3 million was shipped abroad. According to documents seen by The Guardian, after UBC was set up, it transferred $2 million to BBH accounts, and between 1924 and 1940, the assets of UBC hovered around $3 million, dropping to $1 million only on a few occasions. In 1941, Thiessen fled Germany after falling out with Hitler, but he was captured in France and detained for the remainder of the war. There was nothing illegal in doing business with the Thiessens throughout the 1930s, and many of America's best-known business names invested heavily in the German economic recovery. However, everything changed after Germany invaded Poland in 1939. By then, it could be argued that BBH was within its rights continuing business relations with the Thyssens until the end of 1941, as the U.S. was still technically neutral until the attack on Pearl Harbor. The trouble started on July 30, 1942, when the New York Herald Tribune ran an article entitled, "Hitler's Angel Has $3 Million in U.S. Bank," unquote. UBC's huge gold purchases had raised suspicions that the bank was in fact a secret nest egg, unquote, hidden in New York for Thyssen and other Nazi bigwigs. The Alien Property Commission launched an investigation. There is no dispute over the fact that the U.S. government seized a string of assets controlled by BBH, including UBC and SAC, in the autumn of 1942 under the Trading with the Enemy Act. What is in dispute is if Harriman, Walker, and Bush did more than own these companies on paper. Irwin May, a Treasury attaché and officer for the Department of Investigation in the APC, was assigned to look into UBC's business. The first fact to emerge was that Roland Harriman, Prescott Bush, and the other directors didn't actually own their shares in UBC, but merely held them on behalf of Bank for Handel. Strangely, no one seemed to know who owned the Rotterdam-based bank, including UBC's president. May wrote in his report of August 16, 1941, quote, "Union Banking Corporation, incorporated August 4, 1924, is wholly owned by the Bank for Handel and Scheepvaart NV of Rotterdam, the Netherlands. My investigation has produced no evidence as to the ownership of the Dutch bank. Mr. Cornelis Levens, president of UBC, claims no knowledge as to the ownership of the Bank for Handel, but believes it possible that Baron Heinrich Thyssen, brother of Fritz Thyssen, may own a substantial interest," unquote. May cleared the bank of holding a golden nest egg for the Nazi leaders, but went on to describe a network of companies spreading out from UBC across Europe, America, and Canada, and how money from for Handel traveled to these companies through UBC. By September, May had traced the origins of the non-American board members and found that Dutchman H.G. Keuvenhoven, who met with Harriman in 1924 to set up UBC, had several other jobs. In addition to being the managing director of for Handel, he was also the director of the August Thyssen Bank in Berlin and a director of Fritz Thyssen's Union Steelworks, the holding company that controls Thyssen's steel and coal mine empire in Germany. Within a few weeks, Homer Jones, the chief of the APC Investigation and Research Division, sent a memo to the Executive Committee of APC recommending the U.S. government vest UBC and its assets. Jones named the directors of the bank in the memo, including Prescott Bush's name, and wrote, quote, "Said stock is held by the above-named individuals, however, solely as nominees for the Bank for Handel Rotterdam Holland, which is owned by one or more of the Thyssen family, nationals of Germany and Hungary. The 4,000 shares herein before set out are therefore beneficially owned and help for the interests of enemy nationals and are vestable by the APC," unquote, according to the memo from the National Archives seen by The Guardian. Jones recommended that the assets be liquidated for the benefit of the government, but instead UBC was maintained intact and eventually returned to the American shareholders after the war. Some claim that Bush sold his share in UBC after the war for $1.5 million, a huge amount of money at the time, but there is no documentary evidence to support this claim. By the way, this is simply inaccurate. The dissolution of UBC after the war is a matter of public record, and this is a lie. What can I say? In fact, there is a documentary record. Continuing, no further action was ever taken, nor was the investigation continued, despite the fact UBC was caught red-handed operating an American shell company for the Thyssen family 8 months after America had entered the war, and that this was the bank that had partly financed Hitler's rise to power. The most tantalizing part of the story remains shrouded in mystery. The connection, if any, between Prescott Bush, Thyssen, Consolidated Silesian Steel Company, CSSC, and Auschwitz. And the next part of the document talks about some of the involvement of IG Farben, with various firms. And bear in mind that one of the things that looms large vis-a-vis IG Farben and Kohl is the hydrogenation process in which oil could be synthesized using coal, of which Germany had a great deal. And it should be noted that the Standard IG Agreement of 1929 made IG Farben the second largest stockholder in Standard Oil of New Jersey, the most important of the Standard companies. And in return, IG Farben got the rights to market synthetic oil made by the hydrogenation process in Germany, but Standard Oil got the right to market synthetic oil made by hydrogenation all around the rest of the world. And the hydrogenation process provided Germany with most of its fuel in World War II, and it remains in this fuel-starved and increasingly fuel-expensive world one of the large elements remaining in the background, because oil can be synthesized. Not economically competitively in the World War II period, but almost certainly that has changed now. We've talked about that in, among other programs, For the Record 385, and in broadcasts that that deal with the CDU funding scandal, such as For the Record 193. Returning to this Guardian article, the most tantalizing part of the story remains shrouded in mystery. The connection, if any, between Prescott Bush, Thyssen Consolidated Silesian Steel Company, CSSC, and Auschwitz. Thyssen's partner in United Steelworks, which had coal mines and steel plants around the region, was Friedrich Fleck, another steel magnate who also owned part of IG Farben, the powerful German chemical company. Fleck's plants in Poland made heavy use of slave labor from the concentration camps in Poland. According to a New York Times article published on March 18, 1934, Fleck owned two-thirds of CSSC while, quote, American interests, unquote, held the rest. The U.S. National Archive documents showed that BBH's involvement with CSSC was more than simply holding the shares in the mid-1930s. Bush's friend and fellow bonesman, Knight Woolley, another partner at BBH, wrote to Averill Harriman in January of 1933 warning of problems with CSSC after the Poles started their drive to nationalize the plant. Quote, "The Consolidated Silesian Steel Company situation has become increasingly complicated, and I have accordingly brought in Sullivan and Cromwell in order to be sure that our interests are protected," wrote Knight, again quoting. "After studying the situation, Foster Dulles is insisting that their man in Berlin get into the picture and obtain the information which the directors here should have. You will recall that Foster is a director, and he is particularly anxious to be certain there is no liability attaching to the American directors. But the ownership of the CSSC between 1939, when the Germans invaded Poland, and 1942, when the U.S. government vested UBC and SAC, is not clear. SAC held coal mines and definitely owned CSSC between 1934 and 1935, but when SAC was vested, there was no trace of SCSSC. All concrete evidence of its ownership disappears after 1935, and there are only a few traces in 1938 and 1939, says Eva Schweitzer, the journalist and author whose book America and the Holocaust is to be published next month. Silesia was quickly made part of the German Reich after the invasion, but while Polish factories were seized by the Nazis, those belonging to the still-neutral Americans and some other nationals were treated more carefully, as Hitler was still hoping to persuade the U.S. to at least sit out the war as a neutral country. Schweitzer says American interests were dealt with on a case-by-case basis. The Nazis bought some out, but not others. The two Holocaust survivors suing the U.S. government and the Bush family for a total of $40 billion in compensation claim both materially benefited from Auschwitz slave labor during the Second World War. Kurt Julius Goldstein, 87, and Peter Gingold, 85, began a class action in America in 2001, but the case was thrown out by Judge Rosemary Collier on the grounds that the government cannot be held liable under the principle of state sovereignty, unquote. Jan Lissman, one of the lawyers for the survivors, said, quote, "President Bush withdrew President Bill Clinton's signature from the treaty that founded the court, not only to protect Americans, but also to protect himself and his family," unquote. And again, note the difference. People say there's no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats, this last sentence again. Jan Lissman, one of the lawyers for the survivors, said, quote, President Bush withdrew President Bill Clinton's signature from the treaty that founded the court, not only to protect Americans, but also to protect himself and his family, unquote. Listman argues that genocide-related cases are covered by international law, which does hold governments accountable for their actions. He claims the ruling was invalid as no hearing took place. In their claims, Mr. Goldstein and Mr. Gingold, honorary chairman of the League of Anti-Fascists, suggest that Americans were aware of what was happening at Auschwitz and should have bombed the camp. The lawyers also filed a motion in The Hague asking for an opinion on whether state sovereignty is a valid reason for refusing to hear their case. A ruling is expected within a month. The petition to The Hague states, quote, "From April 1944 on, the American Air Force could have destroyed the camp with air raids as well as the railroad bridges and railway lines from Hungary to Auschwitz. The murder of about 400,000 Hungarian Holocaust victims could have been prevented," unquote. The case is built around a January 22, 1944 executive order signed by President Franklin Roosevelt calling on the government to take all measures to rescue the European Jews. The lawyers claim the order was ignored because of pressure brought by a group of big American companies, including BBH, where Prescott Bush was a director. Listman said, quote, "If we have a positive ruling from the court, it will cause President Bush huge problems and make him personally liable to pay compensation," unquote. The U.S. government and the Bush family deny all the claims against them. In addition to Eva Schweitzer's book, two other books are about to be published that raise the subject of Prescott Bush's business history. The author of the second book, to be published next year, John Loftus, is a former U.S. attorney who prosecuted Nazi war criminals in the 1970s. Now living in St. Petersburg, Florida, and earning his living as a security commentator for Fox News and ABC Radio, Loftus is working on a novel which uses some of the material he has uncovered on Bush. Loftus stressed that what Prescott Bush was involved in was just what many other American and British businessmen were doing at the time, skipping down. This was the mechanism by which Hitler was funded to come to power. This was the mechanism by which the Third Reich's defense industry was rearmed. This was the mechanism by which Nazi profits were repatriated back to the American owners. This was the mechanism by which investigations into the financial laundering of the Third Reich were blunted, said John Loftus, who is vice chairman of the Holocaust Museum in St. Petersburg. The Union Banking Corporation was a holding company for the Nazis for Fritz Thyssen, said Loftus, again quoting, "At various times the Bush family has tried to spin it, saying they were owned by a Dutch bank, and it wasn't until the Nazis took over Holland that they realized that now the Nazis controlled the parent company, and that is why the Bush supporters claim when the war was over they got their money back. Both the American Treasury investigations and the intelligence investigations in Europe completely belie that. It's absolute, expletive deleted. They always knew who the ultimate beneficiaries were. There is no one left alive who could be prosecuted, but they did get away with it," says Loftus. "As a former federal prosecutor, I would make a case for Prescott Bush, his father-in-law George Walker, and Abel Harriman to be prosecuted for giving aid and comfort to the enemy. They remained on the boards of these companies knowing that they were of financial benefit to the nation of Germany," unquote. So again, this information is not new to the veteran listeners to this audience. New listeners are emphatically encouraged to use the search function and the various the websites available, the Martin Bormann Nazi in Exile book and the website maintained by the listeners in the Midwest to flesh out your understanding of these affairs. And now there is a lawsuit in the courts about these very things, and that is the news. This concludes For the Record program number 479, World War II era lawsuits and the Bush family. This has been recorded on October 3rd of 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.